Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. The Ukraine war brought Europe and the United States closer together, but are domestic politics on both sides of the Atlantic pulling them apart? Let's get to the bottom line. When Russia invaded Ukraine almost a year ago, NATO went from being brain dead, in the words of French President Emmanuel Macron, to the most essential organization for world peace. At least that's how supporters of the Western-led international order see it right now. But are there signs that the cohesion inside Europe and between Europe and the United States is fraying, especially in the United States, where China is now seen as a much bigger threat than Russia, and folks would rather focus on the cost of living here instead of funding wars abroad? Today, we're talking with Boris Ruge, the former deputy ambassador of Germany to the United States and currently the vice chairman of the influential Munich Security Conference, which convenes next month, and Jacob Heilbrunn, editor of the National Interest magazine and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, and our very own Abdurahim Fukara, bureau chief of Al Jazeera for North and South America. Gentlemen, it's great to be with all of you. And Boris, I'm going to start with you. Can you tell me today, I know you don't represent Germany anymore, you represent the biggest franchise in foreign policy in the world, is Germany all in or not all in fighting Russia and helping Ukraine at this moment?
Well, I guess people can have different opinions on that, but one way of looking at it is that if you compare what Germany is doing now to where it was a year ago in January of 2022, we've come a long way. We've delivered all sorts of weaponry, air defense in particular, heavy artillery. Now we're delivering infantry fighting vehicles. And, you know, we may be delivering main battle tanks. So that's the one item that people feel, many people feel, certainly the Ukrainians, that ought to be made available by Germany. But I think it's you know, glass half full or glass half empty kind of thing.
But what are the fault lines domestically? I know there's controversy over sending German Leopard 2 tanks. You know, the new incoming chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Mike McCaul, has been very critical of Germany for not doing more. And I think that Kevin McCarthy, the new Speaker of the House, who right now is still on board with Ukraine funding, but he sent signals that he believes that Europe is not carrying its own weight, Germany's not carrying its own weight on this, and that you can kind of see that evolving, like, why is the U.S. doing so much and Europe doing so little when it's on the edge of things? So what are the domestic fault lines from your perspective inside Germany and inside Europe? I know this is part of what the Munich Security Conference is going to struggle with.
For sure. So first of all, I would say the observation coming from U.S. friends and colleagues that Europe and Germany in particular ought to be doing more to support Ukraine, that's fair enough because it is in our neighborhood. Kiev is 1,000 kilometers east of where I'm sitting here in Berlin. And so it's fair enough for the U.S. to expect Europe and Germany to be pulling its weight. The domestic fault lines, I think there's a lot of movement. So traditionally, the center-left in Germany has been very reluctant to extend that kind of support. But actually, until the invasion, the second invasion of Russia into Ukraine 11 months ago, across the board in Germany, there were very few people, including in the Conservative Party, who were willing to support that. And that has changed. So the Greens are now very strong in supporting military, extending military support to Ukraine. The Liberal Party, FDP also. Social Democrats, there's a debate going on within that party and different voices. But, you know, step by step, they've been moving in that direction. People say Germany, at the end of the day, has only moved when there's been huge pressure from partners and allies, including the United States, obviously. But Germany has been moving in the right direction. And I think that's the most important thing. If you look at the sum total of what Germany's delivered, it is not insignificant, especially in the area of air defense. But it continues to be an issue of domestic debate.
Jacob, I want to get into the U.S. side in a moment, but I also want to ask you about Europe. I mean, you edit perspectives from around the world with what's going on with regard to support of Ukraine, what Ukraine needs or isn't need, or whether it's a legitimate conflict for the West to be involved with in any case. But as you look at it, how do you see the fault lines of division inside? I was just recently in Eastern Europe, in Poland, and the support for what's going on in Ukraine is very robust. But as you move westward, it's weaker and weaker and weaker and becomes a paler version of the Eastern European tension. At least that's my impression. What's yours?
I think you're exactly right. And what's interesting is that everything Boris said is true, but it's also the case that the German Chancellor Scholz has essentially been wavering, has been too cautious, too timid in approaching this problem. There's a psychological block in Germany and perhaps some of the other countries, which is to recognize there's no going back to the future. There are not going to be the kind of ties with Russia that existed in the past. They are conducting a genocidal war in the heart of Europe. That is not something that you can go back and then suddenly deal with Vladimir Putin on a kissy face basis, as Germany did in the past. Now, the Germans have done a lot, but Poland has become, in some ways, the leader of Europe and may end up with the biggest military in Europe. I'm starting to wonder if Germany really ever will be a leader in Europe. It may be end up being
more
of a follower.
So it may miss its chance entirely. So what you're saying is they're sort of half in, half out.
That's correct.
That's a little different than what Boris said. Boris said they're tilting in the right direction. But I think
they are moving in the right direction, but it's somewhat astounding that the foreign minister, a Green of the Green Party, is much more hawkish than the Social Democratic Chancellor. Annalena Baerbock, the foreign minister, has staked out a much tougher position, and she, too, is much more visible on this than Scholz and the Social Democrats. They strike me as somewhat trapped in the past.
Well, another dimension of this, I want to get to Abdurrahim and you and Boris on this, but I want to show some numbers here, which are very, very interesting. The Chicago Council on Global Affairs has been asking Americans over a period of time, over the last year, about their support for our efforts and Western efforts to support Ukraine in this conflict. I should say that we're indirect. And what this first graph here we shows is that it's gone from 80% support roughly a year ago in the aggregate to about 55% nationally right now. And if you break it down by party, it's really interesting. This has become a very politicized division where the Democrats are overwhelmingly in support, 81% in support of our efforts with Ukraine, 19% opposed. But the divide are 52% of Republicans are against and 48% in favor. To me, that looks like big warning signs of something coming up. How do you see it, Jake?
I agree 100%. I think being anti-Ukraine is going to become a constituent element of the new Republican Party. I think this is the legacy of Donald Trump, and it is why Joe Biden is stepping up the fight now to send tanks and other heavy weaponry to Ukraine. Ukraine is going to have to deliver a knockout blow in the next year.
So, Abdurrahim, I'm so happy you're here because I think sometimes when we have transatlantic discussions, we can get intoxicated by their own importance, you know, when you look at the rest of the world. Because another dimension out there is China's making moves in the world. I sometimes wonder if China's thrilled that the U.S. and Russia and the NATO and the West are all tied up with each other because it opens the chessboard for a lot of other moves by China. I'd be interested from a global perspective what you think our blind spots in this discussion are, and whereas you sitting in Washington, D.C. in the United States, how do you see the divide that's beginning to develop here over Ukraine?
Well, first, let me just say a couple of things about Europe. So obviously the Europeans have been pulled together with the Americans by the Biden administration. We know what the Biden did with regard to the war in Ukraine. However, we are beginning to see strains in Europe. In terms of inflation, in terms of people not finding enough gas to keep themselves warm and so on. So it seems to me that the Americans and the Europeans pulling together, it may be a done deal at least until 2024. 25, if we do have Donald Trump or another Donald Trump in the White House, combine that with European impatience over the prices of energy and so on, and then I think you begin to get a different configuration. And China comes into that. We've already heard noises from Japan just recently about, you know, their concerns about China. And the Japanese were pulled into this because they suddenly see that Ukraine and the Indo-Pacific region have become one. If they stand up to Russia, that's obviously a big statement for the concerns they have about a coalition of the Russians and the Chinese, not just in Ukraine or in the Pacific, but also in Europe. Remember that the Europeans have big interests in another part of the world, that's Africa. And the Americans need them in they need them in North Africa, they need them in West Africa, they need them in other parts of
Africa. We're hardly paying attention to those areas. I mean, and we've had on this show Qin Gang, you know, when he was ambassador of China to the United States. He's now the foreign minister. He's in China right now.
Absolutely.
You know, visiting 5-6 countries there and making it a priority there. But I want to ask from a global perspective, you know, Jacob and Boris have been studying these issues about American engagement in the world for a very long time. And I guess my question is, when you just said Russia and China cooperating, working together, that was supposed to never happen. American statecraft, transatlantic statecraft, was always designed to sort of keep that divide going. How is it that strategic chess players in the Munich Security Conference in Washington, D.C., have somehow allowed conditions where China and the United States, which ought to be geostrategic rivals, are now geostrategic partners?
Well, I suppose that's unintended consequences of the situation in Ukraine. Joe Biden and his administration worked extremely hard in the early days of the war in Ukraine to keep or to bring the Europeans completely on board. We know that the Germans initially were very tentative in terms of supporting the sanctions because they didn't see the sanctions as basically serving the interests of Germany. Joe Biden did manage to surmount that, but you know the unintended consequence is that he brought the Russians, or the conflict in Ukraine has brought the Russians and the Chinese together. You said in your introduction, the Biden administration has said clearly umpteen times they do not see Russia as the greatest menace to U.S. power. They see China. And the Chinese are now everywhere. They are in Africa. They are in the Middle East. They are in the Gulf. They are everywhere.
Right.
And the U.S. will need to turn to those smaller powers in those regions to actually make sure that the Chinese do not get in a big way in those areas.
So, Boris, this is a very important point. I'd love to get your sense of China. You've written about this in your International Politics Quarterly. I highly recommend to people to read Keeping the Transatlantic Mojo, Future-Proofing Transatlantic Relations, which Boris Rugka wrote International Politics Quarterly. And I think that you outline and say that China is going to be a complicated challenge to keep transatlantic relations together because you say inertia isn't going to hold a relationship together. It has to be deliberate. We have to have coordinated plans. We've talked about Ukraine, but how do you see the China challenge for transatlantic relations?
I'm a little more optimistic than what I've just heard, if I can say that. If you think back 12 months when Putin started this invasion, Germany was importing 55% of its gas from Russia. 11 months later, January 2023, we're importing 0%. We're no longer importing oil from Russia. So for all the pain that, and all the difficulty that there's been, I think Europe has, with very strong support from the United States of America, dealt with this crisis. And if Mr. Putin was thinking that he could somehow wrest victory from the situation, what he's seeing is that time and again, the Western allies are stepping up their support for Ukraine. And I think that will continue. And maybe Germany's not going to look very leading, is not going to be ahead of others, but Germany will be there with other partners providing equipment. The other positive that I would see is that when it comes to China, people in Europe, including in Germany, including in the parties that support the government, the Social Democrats, the Greens, the Liberals, have understood that China is a huge challenge. And we have started having a kind of conversation and creating a framework to address the China challenge. That's a big difference from 2 or 3 years ago. And I think the Ukraine situation has also accelerated our understanding of how challenging an actor China is, the kind of scenarios that we might encounter in the Indo-Pacific. So I think we're moving in a good direction.
China, you know, Jacob, I want to ask you something, and you and I have talked about this before, that you see this moment of kind of global reshuffling as an extraordinary opportunity for the United States, for the Biden administration. You have lauded the Biden administration for being very smart in this crisis. And I'd like you to share that with us, but I'd also like to understand from you how fragile that perspective may be, given what we see unfolding in the U.S. Capitol, in Washington, D.C., where there are a lot of people who just want to walk away from the rest of the world.
Right. We may sabotage our own opportunity. I suspect...
Kick down our own hill.
Right. Yeah. I suspect that we are headed potentially towards unipolarity, where the...
So explain that.
Let me explain. That means that the United States, as it was after 1989, 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union, that the United States is not just first among equals, but really the dominant power in the world. And we essentially bungled that opportunity the last time by invading Iraq and squandering our own power and ruining our finances. There is a second opportunity looming, numerous domestic problems in China. And the other one is the potential disintegration of Russia. If those things occur, then there really is no competitor to the United States on the world stage. However, there is as...
But you're assuming that something kneecaps China. And that's not a perspective we often hear right now.
Correct. I shy away from the China hawks. I am not convinced that we are inevitably headed towards a new Cold War with China. I actually think Russia represents the more dire and potent threat right now. China has been pretty careful. But China's domestic problems, I do not think that it is fated that that China will surpass the United States. I don't buy it.
Say this? It seems to me that when it comes to China, the United States has an Achilles heel, which is much closer to home. Just remember, just a few days ago, President Biden heard from the president of Mexico. He heard a sentiment which may have sounded radical to the Biden administration, but to Latin Americans, it's not. He said the U.S. has been treating us with disdain. Couple that with what happened in Brasilia, the shaking of the Brazilian democracy and the repercussions of that for the United States. Remember, China has enormous interests with Brazil, for example, economic interests with Brazil and other nations in Latin America. Get the foundations of democratic systems in these countries that have voted left in Latin America, and you get China looming big on the radar in Latin America, often called the backyard of the United States.
Well, it raised one of the questions about China, which, you know, has been arguing that, hey, we need economic globalization, but we do not need cultural imperialism. We do not need to have every country be shaped the same way. You know, if you look today at Davos is coming up when this show will air. Davos will be underway a couple of weeks after that. We will have the very important Munich Security Conference. And part of what underlies this is whether or not autocracies, illiberalism, is an okay form of government to move economies forward. And I'm just interested, Abdurrahim, into what degree the Chinese model has become very compelling as a North Star for many other economies in the world.
It certainly has. I mean, you take you take Latin America to start with, closer to the U.S.
Right.
Obviously, countries have developed strong ties with the Chinese, and the Chinese philosophy has rung true in Latin America, in Africa, in other parts of the world, meaning the Chinese are saying, I am willing to help you surmount your economic problems, and I'm not going to ask any questions about human rights or freedom of the press like the Americans or the Europeans would do. And a lot of countries in these places are very receptive to that message, especially when they get the impression that the United States, rightly or wrongly, this may not necessarily be true, but in their eyes and in their ears, the United States is trying to disengage from those parts of the world, and they see China as the alternative, perhaps.
Right. In our last few minutes, gentlemen, I want to ask you about the Biden doctrine. Joe Biden Jacob, you and I have discussed this, has been measured in his response, withdrew from Afghanistan, which he didn't really support, even the Obama administration's direction in Afghanistan. He's been measured, I think most people agree, with regards to approaching Ukraine and the conflict with Russia. How do you see the Biden doctrine going? And do you think that he's being defined by Ukraine and these billions of dollars that are going into Ukraine? And will that be something he's celebrated for, or will that crucify him in the 2024 election?
I think his election chances rise and fall in many ways on Ukraine. And that is why he is pushing now hard for some kind of Ukrainian victory in that territory. He obviously wants some kind of negotiation, but he is tougher than his own National Security Council advisor, Jake Sullivan. I think he's more closer to Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State. But yes, Biden and for him, Ukraine must score a significant victory over Russia in the next 6 months, preferably a year at the most, because once the Republicans get control of the fiscal outlays to Ukraine, which they don't have right now because they were passed in November, December by the Congress, then all hell is going to break loose.
Abdur-Rahim, if you were to define a Biden doctrine as you see it from your perspective, what are the key contours of that?
Well, number one is to basically assure people outside the United States that what happened in January 2021 is not going to happen again in the U.S. Because that really shook the confidence of many countries, many of them close allies of the United States, about the American political system and whether they can rely on it to provide security for them in the future. Add to that the fact that the serious concern that the Biden administration must feel if the war in Ukraine doesn't end quickly, and not just in terms of what's happening in the United States, prices and so on. There's people in some parts of the world are beginning to find it difficult to get food, and they're tying that to the Biden decision to support the Ukrainians fight the Russians.
Right. Finally, final word to you, Boris. Does Joe Biden have a doctrine in foreign policy from your perspective?
Well, I think, you know, there's this foreign policy for the middle class, which is a nice soundbite, but what it reflects is that you have to think, when you think foreign policy, national security, you have to, you know, combine a lot of things. Economic development back home, keeping up in terms of technology, all these things. And I think the Biden team has done pretty well in that regard. The one area that I think needs to be looked at closely and where improvement is necessary is a tendency perhaps towards protectionism.
Right.
So better have a transatlantic space and work together on these things rather than closing ourselves off.
Thanks. Great conversation. Really appreciate it. Munich Security Conference, Vice Chairman Boris Ruga and career journalist Jacob Halbrun of the National Interest and Abdur-Rahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? The Ukraine war has been a turning point in history, and it's forcing every country in the world to think about where it stands. Western European countries like being aligned with the United States, but they still want enough wiggle room to go their own way on some issues. America would love to go back to the 90s when it was the world's global policeman and got its way everywhere, but its own internal divisions have undercut its soft power and blocked it from playing all its cards. Meanwhile, most other countries don't want to be tied down by any alliance, whether it's Western or Chinese or whatever else. That means the old order is kind of falling apart, and we're becoming more tribal. And we just care less and less about anyone else, which in turn means more conflicts with the big powers more impotent than ever in dealing with them. And that's the bottom line.